Hello, and welcome to Studies Through the Bible with Pastor Zach Ebarb. I am Pastor Zach, and tonight we are moving on to our next question. So far, we have looked at why we should study the Bible at all. Why does that matter? We have looked at the question of if God is really this holy and loving God, then why would he, you know, let terrible things happen to him? And we're continuing on this line. We're going to answer these questions a lot more about the big picture things first, because we looked at Revelation the week before that, people asking how the world was going to end and kind of what all that would look like from a biblical perspective. And so in answering these big questions, we're moving into yet another very large question, a question that's not only hit my list many times, but has been, according to a couple of surveys and things that I looked at, has been a very big question, for the last 40 or 50 years, probably longer than that, obviously. This is just based on the study. And that question is, why even believe in God at all? Now, when we're getting into this question, there's a couple of difficulties, I guess, that you would say with this question. The number one problem that a lot of Christians have with answering this question is that this question, by nature, exists outside of a discussion about the Bible. When we ask the question, well, why even believe in God at all? The Bible doesn't make an argument, really, at all for the existence of God. It doesn't make an argument for why we should believe in God. In fact, it literally just states that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's the only Bible verse we're really going to talk about tonight is Genesis 1:1. In this discussion of the fact that there is no argument ever made to prove the existence of God. The Bible's premise on this discussion of, well, should we even believe that God exists, or why believe in God at all, however you want to really phrase this question, is you don't really get a choice on the matter. It's a reality in which you decide whether or not you are going to trust in God as your saving grace, right? That's how this whole thing is presented, is that you and I have to factually, realistically understand God does exist, the end. That's the premise of the Bible. And so a lot of Christians get hung up on this, and a lot of lost people get hung up on this, because in our mind, the Bible is the book about God. It's the book about God's Word. Therefore, there should be an answer to this question. Well, there's a couple of reasons why, actually, no, there shouldn't be. Number one, if you are God, the omnipotent creator of the world, and you are writing to men about how to fix their own situation, first of all, you don't owe them anything, for lack of a better way of putting it. You don't owe for an explanation or a discussion or an argumentation as for the existence of God. In fact, I mean, if you go outside and take a look around for a little bit, I think you're going to find more than enough evidence without ever picking up a Bible for the existence of God. So that's the first part of the problem with that perspective. The second part of the problem with that perspective of why doesn't God make an argument for himself is, I'm Zach Ebarb, correct? All of you, you're on a podcast. It's called Studies Through the Bible with Pastor Zach Ebarb. Do I have to make an argument to prove that I do indeed exist? Well, no, because the proof that I exist is the fact that I am known, discussed, and understood, correct? So when we're talking about God making an argument for his own existence, that would be just as foolish as if I got onto this podcast and made an argument to prove that I, Zach Ebarb, do in fact exist. The evidence is very clear that I exist. I'm speaking to you. You're hearing my voice. You know, you've been on this podcast for a while. You know, if you've gotten on Facebook and even done a little bit of digging, I'm sure by now you have found me, okay? I don't have to make an argument. There is evidence that I do indeed exist. And so that's what takes this conversation outside of the Bible and more into the realm of really where this conversation needs to occur, which is in the physical, the scientific, the philosophical, the emotional, these areas of expertise. And the reason for that is the Bible is a book of authority that is telling you that undeniably, factually, realistically, God does exist. That is the premise of the Bible. Therefore, when we have this discussion, we can't have it from the Bible because the Bible is a book of authority, and its authority exists over all of mankind. However, the only bit of men who actually observe and answer to that authority are, of course, those who believe in God. Basically, if my father is my father, then I'm going to obey my father. Whereas if your father is not, if my father is not your father, then you're not going to obey that father. That's essentially what the idea is behind the Bible, is that while all men are under the authority of God, God gives free will to choose whether or not you're going to honor, observe, and accept that authority in your life. And when you have that, that kind of shifts things a little bit, doesn't it? That makes this conversation difficult. Now, when I say difficult, I don't mean that I don't have an answer for you or this is impossible or that there's not substantial evidence for the existence of God or any of those things. I'm saying what makes this difficult is that when somebody is already asking that question, number one, they are fundamentally going against every premise of the Bible. So we can't discuss this from the Bible, meaning that we got to have a better education in other areas of things beyond just the Bible. Probably one of my biggest pet peeves with pastors is that pastors do not seek to expand their knowledge of anything beyond the Bible. And there's a huge reason why that is wrong. Here you go. We're going to talk about another passage of Scripture. In the book of Acts, and if my mind is working with me correctly, it's chapter 16. Don't quote me on that. But in the book of Acts, I believe it is chapter 16, if my old man brain is with me tonight. Paul goes to Athens. And Paul does an incredible thing while he is in Athens. He's waiting on Titus and some other men to come to him. And while he is there, he begins to observe the people, and he begins to have conversations in the streets. Now, what's interesting about the premise that's painted there is that when it says he observes the people, it's the idea that he is paying close attention, like he is focusing on the people of Athens. Well, if I'm taking the time to focus on a particular group of people, there's only one reason that I'm doing that, and that is to learn more about who they are. So Paul is already establishing in the book of Acts the idea that for God's people to have good, intelligent, deep, and impactful conversation with people about God, you have to know who you're talking to. You know, one of the biggest things you hear in seminary over and over and over again from pastors and from preachers and, you know, this kind of thing is, know your audience, know your audience, know your audience, know your audience, know your audience. And I think we know the Christian audience extraordinarily well. I don't think we know the worldly audience even a little bit. So when we have this conversation becomes difficult for Christians and for some even, maybe even impossible to have a good discussion because we don't seek to expand our mind beyond just knowing the Word of God. Like, knowing the Word of God is the most important thing you can do for how to live your life. But for you to be able to teach, preach, reach people where they are, you've got to know more than just the Bible. You can't be a naive believer. You can't be terrified to go and learn something that you may not agree with. You cannot be skeptical of expanding your mind beyond that. And in short, then this may be horribly politically incorrect, God's people shouldn't be stupid. That's basically what I'm trying to say in a nutshell. So we have to take this discussion from the Bible into the realm of whatever authority we are being approached from. I'll give you a good example of that. I'm not going to talk about the existence of God with an atheist the same way that I would talk about the existence of God with a philosopher. Now, don't misunderstand me. This doesn't mean that we're not going to have a conversation about the same points. We are, because God is unchanging. But I'm not going to present that in the same light. I am going to try to meet them where they are. If I'm talking to an atheist about the existence of God, the approach, the authority from which they are asking this question is that of the scientific realm. They're not asking this question from a biblical standpoint. So when we're looking at dealing with this question of, well, how do you even know God really exists? The first thing that we have to establish in this discussion is, where are you approaching this from? Are you approaching this from a scientific perspective? Are you approaching this from a philosophical perspective? Because we cannot approach that question from a biblical one. The Bible does not make an argument for the existence of God. It states that God exists, the end. It's a factual understanding that if you are reading the Bible, you already understand, know, agree with, whatever, that God exists. That's the very premise that's established in Genesis 1:1. For God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, okay? So let's talk about, well, how do we approach this question from a scientific basis? Most of the time when you're talking to somebody who is, I say struggling with this question, but I don't feel like people actually genuinely struggle with this question. I think most of the time this question is a cop-out and an attempt to trip up a Christian who they think does not understand anything beyond the Bible. In short, I don't think this is really a legitimate question. I feel like this is just a smoke and mirror game for most people. And now that's my personal experience. Maybe you feel differently, or maybe you're on here and you have that perspective and you genuinely mean that. I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about the majority of the people in which I have had this discussion. So if we're approaching this from a scientific basis, I actually prefer to deal with somebody who's approaching this question from that point of view, because science remarkably and astoundingly proves the existence of God on a very, very regular basis. And I'll prove that to you, okay? So the first thing that we have to talk about from a scientific perspective that more than proves that there is indeed, quote unquote, a God. All right, since we're having this as a philosophical discussion, not as a I'm a pastor and I believe in the existence of God and I've been saved by Jesus Christ, these kinds of things. Okay. Albert Einstein more than proved this point of view, I believe, is like 1915, if my old man brain is assisting me in this discussion in any way, shape, or form. That Albert Einstein was working on a project essentially discussing how the universe existed. Because when you go back in history, you look at scientists and philosophers and these types from the days of Greece and from the days of early Chinese and Japanese cultures. A very good one is Lao Tzu, which are the Taoist religion. He coined the idea that the universe was eternal. And a lot of scientists kind of accepted this, meaning that the universe had no definite beginning, nor will it have any definite end. It will just keep going on and going on and going on and going on. Now, the issue with that perspective is that if they had actually stuck with that perspective and had proved that that perspective existed, they would essentially be showing and teaching you that the only thing beyond ourselves is the universe as an entirety, meaning that if the universe is self-sustaining, that it is indeed eternal, well then no, there would be no need for a God. But for some reason, Albert Einstein really began studying and getting into what is referred to as cosmology, okay, which is a very fancy word for looking at the stars, okay? And as that research began to go and go and go, And this is a word that terrifies most Christians. I really don't understand why. Do not be terrified of this term. In fact, this term is actually very helpful for you. There is what is referred to, what has been proven to exist, known as the singularity event. You more than likely know it from high school biology or even physical science, possibly. Chemistry, I don't know if chemistry, well, chemistry might discuss that. There's some things involved in that. But anyway, you would most likely know this singularity event by a much sillier name referred to as the Big Bang. Now, do I believe in the Big Bang as the scientific world presents it? No, I do not. However, what's interesting about that theory is that now in modern science, there is a desperate attempt to prove that did not actually occur. And the reason for that is that in that we basically have realized and now understand that the universe did at one point not exist and has now been created and does exist and actually has a definite beginning date. And with that, we see that the universe is constantly expanding, meaning that the actual creation as a whole is not even reached its fullest potential. So when we have this discussion come into play, most Christians hear Big Bang, they lock up the wheels, they freak out, they think that this has to do with evolution and these kinds of things, and basically we just completely and totally jar our brains. We don't want to hear that word. We get terrified by that word. But you actually should celebrate that word, because if the universe has a definite created date, well, then there must be something outside of that. The very nature of science is causation. That's the very nature of the idea. You go outside, you look at a butterfly lands on a flower, the butterfly then drinks the nectar from the flower, and then moves to the next one, and you observe that there's pollen going from one flower to another. And the question you're going to ask is, well, what causes that? What's the point of that? What brought about that? Why is that necessary? That all of science works on the idea of how did something become what it is? What caused this to exist? Meaning that if the universe does indeed have a definite start date, then by the very nature of scientific study, something caused that to exist. Now, that's where you get into kind of the backwards idea of the Big Bang Theory, which is that there's these four forces that were swirling around almost mystically, quite honest with you. And then they collided at just the right time, and bada bing, bada boom, boom, everything existed. Now, what makes that silly is, does that actually answer the question of, well, what caused that? No, because then the question you can immediately ask that individual is, well, where did those four forces come from? To which they're going to say, well, we don't know. But they're going to say that kind of huffily, as if they have just absolutely thwarted you. We don't know yet, but we will know. The reason that they're saying that is because you have to have some sort of being that exists outside of time and space and physical energy and matter that also yet has enough power to bring about this amazing and complex universe, aka you have to have a what? You have to have a God. There has to be a God. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that whatsoever. And you not only do you have to have a God, but because this world exists in time, then you have to have something that exists outside of time, which you and I know more simplistically as the word eternal. So you have to have something that is eternal to create something that is within the realm of time. And so right off the bat, The biggest thing that all scientists just absolutely love for a little bit there, the Big Bang Theory, does actually indeed prove that there has to be a God. There has to be an eternal force that exists outside of this universe to be able to cause this universe to exist. Now, that's not even the only point. That's one of the biggest points. But one of the next points, which to me is much more telling, much more astounding, much more enlightening, to be honest with you, is what is referred to as our just-so universe. That's a commonality that occurs within science, is that things are just-so, 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 just-so. And what they mean by that is the bit essential, like the Big Bang Theory that we just discussed. If that whole event, that singular event in which the universe began, had occurred at even, I believe the idea is like 1 degree of power. I'm trying to remember the exact amount of measurements that they use for it. If that had occurred, even just a little too much power or a little too less power, the universe never would have existed. Meaning that the very fact that the universe exists at all is very, very precise. Okay? Well, that precision goes well beyond that moment. The amount of gravity and friction and oxygen and creation in and of itself, the very shape of the earth, the amount of matter that the earth consists of, all of these things had to be very precise for everything that you know to exist today. Even inside of your body, and your body is probably the most telling sign in the world of the existence of God to begin with. Your body takes part in millions and millions of chemical reactions in a single day. And those chemical reactions must occur at precise moments or you literally drop dead. If your heart does not do its job at the right amount of speed and the right amount of time, things won't happen the way they're supposed to, bada bing, you're dead. And you go into a high school or a college level biology class and they will talk to you like this is astounding because they refer to these very precise reactions occurring as being random. And the reason that they refer to it as that is because it does indeed happen randomly. Now, how we try to buffer that, though, is, well, there's millions and millions and millions of these molecules that are floating around. So while these reactions are technically random, there is such an overwhelming amount of this and that and the other thing floating in the ether that it would be virtually impossible for these reactions to not happen at the right time and in the right method the way they're supposed to. But I want you to understand that even if that is true, 99% of the time your body does the right thing, there still exists this 1% of the time that if your body was to not do the right thing, you would drop dead. Because it is indeed random. The very fact that you walk and talk and have not just fallen over today exists in this random setup inside of your biological makeup that, of course, for me as a child of God, I say, well, that's God interacting and working in your life every day. He maintains your life. It's told many, many times in the Bible that even for the lost, God blesses us with life and with the ability to do what we're supposed to do. Well, how would he do that? Well, because even though your body literally works at random from a scientific perspective, somehow it always still hits the mark the way it's supposed to, huh? Things still happen the way they're supposed to. You and I have not dropped dead during this conversation. And whether we like it or not, essentially one out of every 100 chemical reactions that occur in your body, and that is millions a day, should always fail, yet it doesn't. That's the theoretical, mathematical, statistical analysis of that breakdown of random, is that we should all have dropped dead many, many years ago based off of the statistics of it all, yet here we are. So, already, do we have a singular event that points to the fact that there has to be an eternal and very powerful being that exists outside of the universe to actually bring it into existence? But we also have an immense amount of precision. Everything in your universe, if it was not just so, not you would not exist. life as a whole would not exist. That's an incredible realization in my mind. I don't know how you could actually work and live and be in the scientific world and not believe that there is a God, to be quite honest with you. To even be able to ask that question, which is why I said most of the time when I deal with people with this question of, well, how can you even prove God exists? Why should we even believe in God at all? It's extremely silly to me because these people unearth things every single day that point out with a big neon sky, a little sign in the sky that says there is a God. They see things and work with things every day that would absolutely blow your mind. And for the normal average human being, point you directly to God, yet in the foolish arrogance of this world and in the realm of the scientific community, they look at that and go, well, no, there's not a God. There's this, you know, there's these other forces at play, such as evolution. Even when we look at the idea of evolution, first of all, I don't believe in macroevolution for a number of reasons. Number one, you can't prove it, you can't observe it, you can't anything from a scientific standpoint. It will literally never be provable because there's no way to observe it. But the other reason that I don't in any way, shape, or form believe in macroevolution is because macroevolution essentially, as a whole, exists within the realm of every single thing that's happened to this moment where we and you and I are sitting right now happened by accident, which to me is hilarious. There was millions and millions and millions and millions of years, and whether you're on here as a Christian, you believe in young earth theory or an old earth theory, and we will get to that question in case you're sitting there going, what in the world are those? That question is on the list to come up, okay? Yeah, essentially in a nutshell, young Earth, you agree with the scientific community that the world is millions and millions and millions of years old. And if you're old Earth, you believe that the world's roughly 6,000 years old. Essentially that God made and created the Earth already at its fully mature state to allow and to inhabit life. Okay, and we'll talk about the differences of those two in a podcast on down the road. But so, you know, scientists will even tell you, oh, well, it's millions and millions and millions and millions of years. You know, a lot of accidents can happen in that time that could lead to today. Statistically, doesn't add up. Not even a little bit. If we are going to go, according to all of these random reactions that they are telling you happen all the time, if we go and even look at microevolution, which is essentially adaptation, that animals that have better traits, survive, and ones that do not get eaten. If we go and observe these kinds of things taking place, there are a ton of animals that quote-unquote evolve in a miraculously short amount of time. Meaning that there's no way in the world, even if we have millions and millions and millions and millions of years to just add on the pile, that you just accidentally happen to exist. Because you have a very precise universe. So, on the science end of this question of, well, does God really exist? Why should I believe that God exists? However you want to phrase that question. From a scientific perspective, I feel like there's an overwhelming amount of evidence to prove why you should believe God exists. Now, you know, could I make an argument for the God of the Bible? And from a scientific perspective, no. But I would move you from, here's the proof that a God exists, and here is that God. That would be my approach to that question. Now, maybe you're on here and the science is completely outside of the realm, and you're more in the philosophical approach to this question of, well, does God really exist? Why should I believe in God? Because there are two different approaches. The one is the scientific, the factual, the logic-based discussion. Okay. And then the other one is more of an emotional-based, personal experience-based question. And when you are dealing with this question on a philosophical level, we have to unpack a lot of things first. First thing that we have to unpack is that there is a lot more emotion involved in this situation than there should be. One such premise is that most of the time, when you are dealing with anyone who has a psychological psychology background, clinical psychology background, a philosophy background, a comparative religion background, basically any background that deals with ideas, okay? There's a lot of emotion wrapped up in that, and what I mean by emotion is that most of all of those fields present a very opposite idea about humanity than what the Bible presents. Most of those fields present the idea that humanity is morally good, whereas the Bible's argument is that humanity is morally corrupt, morally evil, meaning that at your very essence, you are what is referred to as a sinner by nature, meaning that 99.9% of the time, you and I seek after things that are either selfish, evil, wrong, abominable, for lack of a better way of putting it. And when you have a philosophy approach to this question, they are looking at it as, well, humanity is mostly good. Okay, you know, that deep, deep down, we all desire to do the right thing, and we all desire to do good things. And so when we get to this discussion, this one is a much more heated discussion than the logic fact-based one, okay? The most heated you're going to get in that scientific realm is that, well, you're an idiot because you believe in God. That's about as far as it's going to go. In the philosophical one, things get a little more rowdy. So first of all, one of the things that you get into with this philosophical discussion is that God in and of itself is not observable, okay? And why that tends to come into that, and it comes into play in the scientific discussion as well, just not nearly as much as it used to. It used to a long time ago, and then this answer to the question came out, and they kind of just let that one go. The reason that they bring this in of, well, God's not observable, is because even when we're dealing with human psychology, we're dealing with ideas, we're dealing with philosophy, a lot of that still has a very scientific background, which is very funny because you're dealing with ideas, yet you're approaching ideas in a scientific way. And so in their mind, we cannot observe God. We don't hear God, we don't speak to God, we can't touch God, feel God, all of these things. We'll just wrap it all in one. Therefore, how do we really know that God exists? Well, the very nature of these types of approaches, psychology, comparative religion, they deal with ideas. And so my first response always to this is, well, how do we know that your idea exists? I can't touch your idea. I can't taste your idea. I can't observe your idea. However, I can tell that your idea matters to you. It's like your emotions. If you're on here and you have a spouse, please explain to me how in the world you love that person. What does that mean? What does that look like? Can I taste it, touch it, look at it? No. I can't at all. In fact, you couldn't even explain it, could you? You might do something like, well, I mean, you know, I saw him, I saw her, and, you know, in the pit of my stomach, I just knew. Well, just knowing is not an explanation, is it? It doesn't explain that to you. Another very good idea. How many times do you get angry and you don't know why you're angry? Oh, a lot of times, right? I would say about 99% of the time when you and I get angry about something, we really don't even know why we got angry. In fact, we will sit down and go, okay, well, why am I angry about this? And try to sort that idea out, that emotion out. Well, I can't observe anger in the sense of I can literally look at the essence of anger. I can't touch the very essence of anger. I can't taste. I can't feel, I can't see the essence of anger, yet anger exists. Love exists. These things that you and I cannot in any way, shape, or form approach scientifically, they not only exist, but we believe so strongly in them that we partake in them on a regular basis, do we not? Yeah, we do. So even when you're talking about this scientifically or philosophically, that's a huge point to make of there's a ton of things that we have to believe in that we only know from a psychological standpoint. We can't even really explain why it is. You know, even if a scientist tries to, well, you know, love is this particular hormone and that particular hormone, and they all connect, and your blood pressure rises, and your vessels open up, and blah, 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 blah. They're not actually describing to you love. In fact, they're describing to you a much, 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 much different reaction, and that would be lust. When you look at anger and they try to explain anger away, well, yeah, you have a raise of adrenaline and endorphins, and you want to do this, but that does not explain why someone's words would cause you to be angry. That is an idea. That is something that exists within the psychology of humanity that we cannot explain it, not even a little bit. But another thing that we have to look at when we're getting into this idea of the philosophical is we have a big, big, and very important aspect to all of us. And that is what I refer to as a collective morality. Some people will refer to this as goodness, and the reason that I don't refer to this as goodness is because it is not good in and of itself. When you talk about the Bible, you know, the rich young ruler comes to Jesus, and it's recorded in Matthew and Luke and a few others. And he comes to Jesus and he says, "Good master, good teacher, you know, what must I do to be saved?" That's the premise of it. And Jesus looks at the young man and he says, "Why callest thou me good?" Yes, this is very KJV. So just look at those verses in whichever one you like. Okay. That's what the day and time I grew up in. Therefore, that's the translation that I speak in. Okay. What Jesus is essentially telling this young man is that you cannot refer to a human as good, because the only one that is good is God. "Why callest thou me good? For there is but one good, and that is God." Meaning that the very idea of being good is that we have to be without sin. We can't genuinely be good. We can't genuinely be holy. We can't genuinely be what we are supposed to be from a righteous standpoint unless we're without sin. Well, that immediately takes all of us off the table. So I don't ever use the word good with this, because if you and I do something that we would refer to as quote-unquote good for another person, and we do it for any reason beyond a desire to serve and honor and glorify God, well, what is the reason that we are doing it for? Well, it's a selfish reason, correct? If I go and I see a guy broke over on the side of the road and his tire's off his truck, my immediate thought in the flesh is, well, you know, if I'm ever on the side of the road and my tire's off, I would hope some guy would stop and help me change it. Okay, well, what's the basis of me making? Am I doing that because I'm good? Am I doing that because it's morally right? Because it's pleasing to God? Is that what's happening in that psychology? No, that's not what's happening. I'm saying I hope that if this happens to me, somebody else would do this for me. So what's really the basis of my motivation? Well, it's myself. It's a selfish motivation. It's something that humans have done for millions of years. That's how civilizations are built, or thousands of years, depending on which of those old young earth theories you believe in that we talked about earlier, okay? It's something that has driven humanity since they were created and fallen. That, well, if I scratch your back, you'll scratch mine. You see this behavior constantly, even in your own culture right at this moment. And so, I don't refer to it as goodness. I refer to it as a collective morality. Meaning that if you're on here, whether you believe in Jesus Christ as your personal Savior, your child of God, or you're listening to this to find out whatever this crazy guy is saying regarding this question, and you don't believe in any of that at all, and you're just taking a peep down the rabbit hole, I think that you and I and everyone else on here could agree that murder is wrong, right? I think we could all agree in that. You know, you might be on here trying to play devil's advocate and go, well, I mean, murder under what context? Murder is murder is murder. There's no appropriate context. We kind of like to get that vigilante justice every now and again. But even that, whether you like it or not, is in and of itself murder. So, we can all agree, even if you've got a little bit of a loose end on the idea, that murder is wrong. I think we could all collectively agree that stealing is wrong. And again, you may try to play devil's advocate and go, well, what if your family is starving and you're going to steal a loaf of bread to feed your family? To which my response to you is you have now stolen a loaf of bread out of the mouth of another family who is now going to starve as a result of your decision. Meaning that, even if you want to try to play this what if devil's advocate game of gray area ethics or situational ethics, as it's referred, stealing is still wrong. If I stole something from you, you'd be angry regardless of what other reason I stole it for. Okay? I think we could all agree that adultery and cheating on your spouse is wrong. I think we could all collectively agree that be coveting or being jealous over something that your neighbor has, which of course is going to lead to problems down the road, that's morally wrong. I think we could all agree that lying is morally wrong. You know, you may try to play the situational ethic card, but at the end of the day, lying doesn't ever lead you to anything good, regardless of your motivation for it. The point of all of me saying all of this is that even though you may be on here and don't even remotely believe in what I believe in, we are yet arriving at similar moral conclusions. Now, we may not agree on morality and when we get into things such as homosexuality or abortion or dealing with how justice should be carried out in the world or how human life should be looked at and considered and what should come into play with that. We know we're gonna have a lot of differing areas in other places, but on a very basic fundamental level, you and I are going to share a collected morality. Meaning that we're gonna agree that yeah, murder's wrong. We don't like that. And the reason that we can agree on all of that is because whether scientists like this or psychologists like this, we have a quote-unquote conscience. We have a moral compass, and it exists from very early on. Like, it's not something that's taught. A big argument about that is that it's taught, that it's taught, that it's taught. It's not true at all. There's countless children, especially right now in this nation, in this day and time, that are coming from violently abusive homes, coming from drug abuse homes, coming from alcohol abused homes, coming from homes in which sexual perversions have been committed on the child. We're talking about abominations that I see on a regular basis in the area that I pastor in that would send shivers down your spine. That these kids still come out of these things knowing that that is wrong, and many of them going on to live perfectly quote-unquote, normal lives. Meaning that they don't do this to somebody else. They believe that this is wrong, despite the fact that the learned behavior, the implied behavior at home, is that this is completely normal and okay. Well, how is it that little Johnny can come out of that situation and believe that all of these things he has been taught are acceptable, and he's been taught them indirectly? Meaning that even though they didn't say, well, this is okay to do, he has observed adults partaking in this behavior and realizing implicitly that this behavior is normal, yet in his elderly years realizes that no, this is not at all normal, it's not right, it's morally wrong. Well, how does that happen? Well, that happens because you're programmed to know on a very basic fundamental level right from wrong. And that's all of humanity. Now, this throws a huge, huge, huge monkey wrench into both the philosophical approach to this question and the scientific approach to this question. And the reason for that is that if you and I evolved from a single-celled amoeba floating around in the water one day that then collectively became a multicellular organism that then moved on into a fish, and then the fish, for some weird reason, decided to grow legs, and then went from his legs onto land and essentially became somewhat of a giant salamander, and then went from a salamander into reptilian life, and from reptilian life into mammalian life, and then from mammalian life into you and I are a monkey's uncle. We have a problem here. Where did the morality come from? I can observe all of these other things that I quote-unquote share a molecular DNA genetic lineage with that have no morality whatsoever. I have chickens in my backyard. If I raise chickens, we raise rabbits, I hunt, I fish, you know, these kinds of things. I'm around animals a lot. Got dogs, whatever. If I go outside and I find a chicken and that chicken is wounded, okay, the chicken is hurt, you know, chickens are not very intelligent animals, they get themselves into all kinds of predicaments. If I go out in the back and I see that one of our birds is hurt, I need to immediately remove that bird. And no, it's not just to deal with the actual physical problem. The reason that I have to remove it is that the rest of the birds, if they realize that this bird is wounded, it's injured, it's weaker, they will kill it. They will peck it to death, they will attack it, they will continue to abuse it over and over and over and over and over again until eventually they've killed the bird. Well, you and I just said that we believe that murder is wrong. Well, what are these chickens partaking in on one of their own kind, by the way? That, I mean, they could be out there with that other bird 5-6 years, they'll still do this. Well, they're murdering that bird, and then many of them come back, and after they've killed the bird, they eat that bird. Well, why does that violent behavior exist amongst these animals? Yet, with us, we have government and justice systems and all these things. We have this moral, spiritual side that exists to us that nothing else in the world has. Where does that come from? And I know the scientific answer to that is, well, your brain developed a certain way, and bada bing, bada boom, it just magically happened. I don't find that to be a very acceptable answer. That'd be no different than if my toddler came in with cookie crumbs on her face, and I said, how is it that you've come to acquire these cookies that you weren't supposed to be in? And she said, well, I mean, you know, I was on a chair, and then bada bing, and bada boom, it just happened. That's not an acceptable answer from my toddler, let alone from somebody who has a PhD and spent 12, 14 years of their life in school. The simplest answer to that is that there is a God, that God exists, that God has built every single soul on this planet in his image, which is something that the Bible refers to over and over and over again, meaning that you and I are designed in a parallel relationship to who God is, meaning that you and I are a three-part being, we're body and mind and soul. God is in and of himself that same idea. He's three in one. You have the Holy Spirit, you have the Son of God, you have God the Father. And all three carry out different roles, yet are one. It's the same concept. You and I are flesh, we're also emotion, yet at the same time, we exist within the spiritual realm. It's a very hard thing to wrap your mind around, yet it's 110% true. You can see that in the collective morality of humanity. That somehow this right and wrong premise exists, that we have no explanation for how it came to be or why it is that we do it. If we are merely just animals walking the face of this planet, well, there shouldn't be anything wrong with me going next door and killing my neighbor. There shouldn't be anything wrong with me going next door and stealing something that I like. There shouldn't be anything at all wrong. There should be, in fact, no police, no government, no hierarchy, no anything. We can fall into basic tribalism, and the people that we like or don't like are the ones that we keep in the group, and if we don't like them, we kill them. It's what animals do on a regular basis. So when you're approaching this question philosophically, just as if you approach it scientifically, there's a lot of holes in the boat and a psychological argument for, well, I mean, why should I believe in God? You have every reason in the world to believe in God. The fact that humanity even has any sense of morality at all speaks heavily to the existence of God. It speaks very clearly to the fact that God exists. But there is one more side of this philosophical conversation that we do have to have. And I mean, truly, this could be a very powerful point as well as it could be for many people. They just kind of blow you off. They don't really care about this. But another question that we have to look at is personal experience. Meaning that you and I, if you've been on this earth for even 20 years, you have had the time to see some interesting things occur. You've had time to see things that should not have ever happened happen, good, bad, ugly alike. You've had the ability to spend time watching people, observing people, learning behaviors, seeing the way that humanity operates as a whole. But you've also gotten the opportunity to observe many, many things that you cannot explain. Things that you, to this day, you'll go, well, I mean, it was nothing short of a miracle. I'm sure many of you have made this phrase before. It was nothing short of a miracle. Because there's a lot of times in this world that things happen to people that we know and love or to ourselves that doctors, lawyers, scientists, police officers, sometimes even pastors, cannot explain. Now, I have no idea how in the world you wrecked that car and every other part of that car folded up, but magically the spot you were sitting in. I had a very bad car wreck when I was about 17, 18 in high school. That I might get a little spiritual on you, that I fervently believe was 110% God's doing, because I had surrendered to preach when I was 14 years old. And I kind of had this idea, well, I surrendered to preach, but like I'll get to that when I get to that. That was my attitude. I would go preaching places here and there, and I preached at a nursing home for many, many years while I was in high school. And that to me, that was me giving God his bone. But my desire and my dream was to enter into the Navy and to go to Annapolis, Maryland, and go to the Naval Academy at Annapolis, and to go from the Naval Academy into the SEALs and train off the coast of California. That was my dream, and I'd throw God a bone, and I'd be a Navy chaplain, and I'd preach here and there, and when I got done doing the things that I wanted to do, I'd come back around to this whole preaching thing. And I was about 2 to 3 weeks out from signing all my paperwork. I'd eaten with the governor and met with the governor and done the interviews and basically this whole very, 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 very long drawn out process to be able to even be considered for the school, let alone to attend it. And I was on my way, passed my physicals, passed all my training, passed all these things, got my papers all approved. It's a big, huge ordeal. And my parents asked me to run down to the store. I grew up in a little itty-bitty town, so yes, it was a general, to grab my father something that he wanted. And it was something just ludicrously silly, as Pop-Tarts, some kind of things we probably should not have eaten, okay? And so I go down to the store. I'm 2 weeks out from signing these papers. And I'm going to go to Maryland, and I'm going to go be in the Naval Academy, and I'm going to go from the Naval Academy, and I'm going to be a Navy SEAL. That's what's going on in my 17, 18-year-old brain at the time. Go down, I get the stuff, and I'm driving back home. And I'm only maybe 15 minutes from my home. It's a very small town. Going down the highway, and the car ahead of me was having some weird thing going on with their lights. It looked like their turn signals were both intermittently going off. It wasn't the emergency flashers, but rather it was like one light would flash, the other light would flash, and then the other light would flash. And needless to say, this was a little bit of what we call back home a hoopty, meaning it's a junk car. It was a very bad car. And so I'm following this car for 2 or 3 miles. We're doing 15, 20 under the speed limit. So for those of you that have all been 17, 18 years old, you know the level of impatience that I have reached by this point. And I see a hand come out the window that looks as if it's flagging me to go around this individual. So I whip over, even though it's not a passing lane, because this is the country and this is what we do for those of you that don't live in the country. Okay, I'm going to go around this person. And all of a sudden, I'd gotten maybe a quarter past that car. About a quarter of my front end had gotten past this other car. The car turned into me, spun me out, put me in a ditch, brought me back up out of the ditch, turned the car 180 degrees, set me down in the other lane facing the opposite direction. Crushed the car, dropped all four wheels, crushed the back end, all these things. I had enough of an adrenaline rush that I got out of the car, went over to the other person's car. It turned out that the lady was both high, drunk, and she was smoking a cigarette, and what I thought was signaling me to come around her was actually her flicking her cigarette. And didn't think anything was wrong. I had gotten out of the car. I'd gotten over and got them out of the car. Nobody was hurt, end quotes. Everything was good. There was a little bit of issues with the police officers and things of that nature because she had done wrong and I had done wrong, and they had to sort all this out. Because even though it's a country, when you get in a wreck, now you're playing by the law, okay? I go home. Essentially, the worst thing is that I've wrecked the car that I've bought that I love dearly and had my whole day slowed down and now had to deal with problems with insurance and police officers, those kinds of things. I wake up the next morning and I am very sore, as you would expect. And I go to stand up out of my bed and fall on my face because I cannot feel my back, not even a little bit. My mother takes me to the ER, and I had ripped every muscle down my spine. I mean, every muscle. Not to the point that I was paralyzed, but to the point that getting up was not going to be an easy thing. And so in short, that ended the military thing altogether. If I was to go in, they would let me go in because I had a 93 on my ASVAB. And I could be a paper pusher, but my idea of going into the military would never occur. Never, never, ever. And so I went home very, very angry, of course, at that particular time. And a pastor approached me about 2 weeks after I'd done it and essentially said, "So are you going to do what God called you to do yet, or are you going to just mope around and be mad at how this all worked out?" Why am I telling you this? Well, I'm telling you this because this is what I'm talking about of personal experience. I can look back on my life at that moment, and I 100% believe that God Almighty allowed that car to wreck. Now, today, my back, much better position than it ever was. I walk around. I do all the things that I want to do. Yet, it was bad enough at the time, it ended what I was trying to go after that I wasn't supposed to be going after. I think it's very mystical that a back that should never work the way that it works now does work the way that it does now, but it didn't work good enough to be able to go down that path. When you and I look at life, I'm sure every one of you have either a story about your own life where God completely and totally just turned your car around, both literally and figuratively. Or you've seen God work very strongly in the life of somebody else, maybe somebody that you love that should have been dead, that is not dead, that the doctors will tell you, "Well, I have no idea how that happened." Guys, these doctors, these lawyers, these scientists, whoever it is that who's telling you, "I have no idea how this happened," they've worked a very long time in their field. They've spent a lot of time doing things. Their job is to literally know what's going on, when it's going on, how it's going on, and how it could be that this happens. And when one of those people look at you and say, "I haven't a clue how this has occurred," that's God. 100% God. I don't think for a single solitary second that that's anything short than God interceding in the life of somebody whose time it just simply is not yet. So when we are looking at the question of, well, why should I believe in God? My answer to you is going to be, why don't you believe in God? That's going to be my answer. And my answer is because it's a massive amount of scientific evidence for why God exists. From that singular event, as we talked about, that you more likely know as the Big Bang. From the fact that you have a just-so universe, a very precisely built, very precisely laid out universe, that I find it very, very interesting that such precision could come from accidental behavior and genetic spread over time. To the fact that we all have a collective morality. We all have personal experiences that we cannot explain where things happen, that in this physical, finite, time-filled, matter-filled world should never have been able to happen, all the way to the fact that you and I, as human beings and as individuals, all have an innate sense to worship and to seek for something that is greater than ourselves. There's countless, countless evidence, well outside of the Bible stating this is the fact, God did indeed create the heavens and the earth, meaning there is a God. There's no argument made beyond that. There is so much evidence that it's astounding for why God does indeed exist and why you should believe in God as a whole. So if you're on here and you're not a Christian, I hope that this appealed to you in some forms or fashions and maybe prompted some questions. As you guys know, you're allowed to ask questions. You drop questions in the comment bar. I'll answer you. We'll talk about them on this podcast. That's kind of the direction that we are taking from where we were going and trying to help you to study the Bible more effectively, as well as to answer questions that are holding up a lot of believers and a lot of lost people from better understanding the Bible and the universe as a whole. But if you're on here and you're saved, and you are a child of God, I hope that this helps you not lose your mind when you hear this question. To not be intimidated by this question, to not be scared about this question, and not only to help you with that, but also to help you have a desire to go on and seek more and more knowledge in the realms of these things. Because if you and I don't know our audience, we certainly can't present our message in a way that they are going to understand. And so that is the wrap up of the question of why should I believe God is real? What is the evidence for the existence of God? I hope that all of you enjoyed it. This is now our fourth question. We've talked about why it's important to study the Bible. We've talked about how the end of the world is going to look. We've talked about many different aspects of questions such as how is it that a holy God who is loving and powerful and all these things would allow evil to exist in the world. And now to add to that collective for you, the question of, well, how do we even know that such a God exists? And so at this time, I hope that all of you and have a very wonderful week. We'll be right back here again at 7 o'clock. We weren't here last Monday as I had a church camp and I had to preach and teach that camp. And so we just put out one of the recordings from the prior week so that you guys had that to listen to if you didn't get to catch up on it. Next week, we're going to be jumping into another deep question. No, I'm not going to tell you what it is. That just gives you an incentive to return the next week at 7 o'clock. I hope that all of you have an excellent week. God bless all of you. And as always, you guys get out of here and go study.